Maine's June primary is drawing near, and today we bring you two in our series of Your Vote 2018 interviews with the candidates vying for their party's nominations in the race for governor and for Maine's 2nd District congressional seat. Over the next few weeks, we'll hear from all 14 primary candidates on a range of key issues. We'll also find out why each believes that they're the best choice to represent their party in the general election this fall. If you miss either of our interviews in this hour, you can hear all 14 at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote page. Today, we'll hear from Craig Olson, one of three Democrats vying to challenge Republican incumbent Congressman Bruce Poliquin, and Diane Russell, a Democrat facing six opponents in this year's gubernatorial primary. First, Craig Olson runs an Islesboro bookstore and manages the town's transfer station. He served for 3 years on the town board of selectmen and a year as chair. Prior to that, he was CEO of Kelmscott Rare Breeds Foundation in Lincolnville, a working farm and education center. Olson holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Platteville and a master's degree from the State University of New York at Oneonta and the New York State Historical Association. As he told Maine Public's Mal Leary, his first priority in Congress would be universal health care.
And it's something that I really was the reason I got into this race, because I'd had a bout with skin cancer about 3 years ago. And we were really fortunate to have coverage through the Affordable Care Act. And when I saw our current member of Congress voting against that act over and over, it really is the impetus for me. And it's something that I really wanted to fight for at the federal level.
But how does that set you apart from your opponents, because they all support expanded coverage as well?
They do support it, and I think what sets me apart is the fact that I really want to see it established in the same way that we establish Medicare, and that we have a 10% fee on every working American. 5% comes out of the worker's pocket, 5% out of their employer, and we have a standard level of care. And none of the opponents in the primary have really come up with a plan as to how you fund that health insurance, universal health insurance in the U.S., and that's really been a proposal that I've put forth.
All the polls are continuing to show that jobs are the biggest concern for voters, particularly in the 2nd District. What would you do as a member of Congress to help grow the economy?
I think for me, one of the biggest things that I would push for is working more with helping develop regional economies within Maine. You can't just use a cookie-cutter approach to the entire state. You have to look at each different region of the state. I think with the forest products industry in northern Maine and tourism, we need to be bringing in more research, more things to do with that cellulose fiber that comes out of our trees. Along the coast, along with tourism, I think the other thing we need to be looking at are what are those renewable energy systems like an offshore wind turbine field that would help bring and lower energy costs in Maine, but also bring more people in to the coastal region. And for all of Maine, really, we have to have universal broadband that reaches every corner of the state. And that is something that's going to have to be funded by the federal government with additional help from the state and local municipalities. And it's going to have to be a different mix for each community. Where I live in Islesboro, we were able to establish our own municipal broadband system. It's a town utility now, and we were able to do it because we have a high tax base. But other communities don't have the tax base we have. They should be able to look for funding from the federal government, from state municipalities, and from private companies.
What do you see as the most pressing issue facing the country? And what would you try to do to address it as a member of Congress?
I think, again, it comes back, and as I talk to people in the district, it's about health care, number one. People just not knowing how they're going to handle their later years, or even if they have young children now and skyrocketing costs to cover a family. But the other thing is really jobs and the out-migration of young people in Maine. We're losing more people in Maine than are being born, and we need to be doing more with encouraging immigration, bringing people in, but also combating that with broadband and all these other factors to make sure that we can have people living wherever they want to in Maine and viable incomes.
So what do you do in Congress to try to achieve that goal?
I think, number one, you go for funding more for energy projects like the wind turbine systems that we're looking at off the base, off the coast. We look at infrastructure for broadband, but physically roads and bridges and improving things, but also rail for getting product in and out of this state. We have a lot of rail lines in the state that are dormant. I think we need to be rebuilding that rail, not necessarily building big four-lane highways, but actually utilizing the infrastructure that's been there for a century.
Now, voters participating in the June primary elections are going to be using ranked choice voting for the first time. Now, I'm assuming you plan to rank yourself as your top choice, but who's your second and who's your third choice?
Good question. Yes, I'm going to be number one for myself. Two and three, the jury is still out. I'm still trying to figure that one out, and I may not know until I walk into that voting booth on June 12th.
Maine is a graying state, and the second district's aging even faster. Do you support any specific changes to Medicare or Social Security?
I do. I number one, we need to not mess with Medicare and Social Security in access, and we can't keep calling them entitlement programs. People have paid into that system. They deserve to draw from that system. One thing I would like to see is that we take that Medicare wage, the Medicare age eligibility at 65, drop it to 55. I think there are a lot of people out there who are working probably pretty difficult jobs, who are in their late 50s, early 60s, who would be very happy to retire and would be able to utilize that Social Security. And if they could get their Medicare coverage earlier in life, they may step back, which would open up jobs for other people. But I think you have to fight every day in Washington to make sure that people aren't carving out of that Medicare and Social Security system.
President Trump has imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum. Some Maine companies are already being hurt by that move. Do you support those tariffs, and why or why not?
I don't support unilateral tariffs where somebody just steps up to a podium and announces we're going to do this and then directs his department to start that. I think you have to have trade negotiation between countries. It is an incredibly complicated area when it comes to international relations and trade. You have to have your Commerce Department at the table, but you also have to have your State Department at the table. You need to be looking at what works best for the countries. There are going to be winners, there are going to be losers, but I think that the gap is so stark right now that we really have to be sitting down in a negotiation setting and not simply doing things arbitrarily.
So you don't agree the president is on this, this bilateral discussion. You're saying we probably ought to be looking at multilateral discussions.
I really do think it has to be multilateral. It is not easy and it is not simple. There's so much gray area. And again, I'm not a trade expert, so I'm sure there's so many other there are other people who know much more about that than I do. But it really, from a person who is a small business person looking at what's going on, it really to me seems like something we need to sit down and negotiate over a period of time.
Name one issue on which you see yourself voting against the wishes of your party leadership, and why?
For me, I grew up on a dairy farm, and when growing up there on a dairy, and you see what happens with farm subsidies that goes to very large farming, I'm very not in favor of the large farm subsidies that we ship out to the Midwest to these large, what really are corporate farms, to the detriment of small farmers. I'd really like to see funding come from the Department of Agriculture that is helping transition farms between older farmers who want to retire and have nobody to take the farm over, and young people who want to farm in almost a microloan type of situation, not only for the land but also for those ongoing costs and ongoing education about what it is to farm in a rural community in Maine.
Any others that you can think of that where you would buck your party leadership?
Not right now. There are so many, a lot of this question that comes up many times is about leadership in the party and Nancy Pelosi becoming, when Democrats win in the fall, Nancy Pelosi becoming becoming the Speaker of the House again. And that's not something I'm not sure how I would vote. I don't know Nancy Pelosi. For me, it's just going to be something that I look at when I get to that situation.
Do you intend to hold what we call traditional town hall meetings to hear from your constituents? And if so, would you put any restrictions on the folks who are attending those meetings?
Oh, of course I would have town meetings, as many as I could have, and no restrictions. I mean, you're a public servant. You're serving all the people of the 2nd District. I live in a small town, and there are a lot of people that I don't agree with, and we sometimes will have heated discussions over things, but we all get along in the long run, and you learn something from those discussions. I think too often we put ourselves in a fishbowl, only listening to the news that we agree with and only looking at things on Facebook that we've liked. And I think that we really lose that that sense of what your entire community and that perspective of other people. And you're a public servant. I really feel you're required to go out and talk to your people. You're required to have your office open and have office hours and be available.
Recreational use of marijuana is now legal in Maine. Do you support Congress legalizing recreational use nationally? And why or why not?
I do, because I think it's something that really could benefit. It's not only going to benefit states in tax revenues, but I think when you're looking at the issues that we have with the opioid crisis in Maine, ways that people are beginning to manage pain, you do their pain management through opioids, it then spirals into an addiction process that just is devastating. And I think that there are ways to manage pain creatively through cannabis-based products. We're seeing that in places like Colorado and others that have legalized it. But I also think that not only do we need to legalize it, we need to tax it, we need to regulate it, and we need to start doing scientific studies. What are the long-term effects of marijuana use? What are the long-term effects on people over in the 21 age group, and what are for older people? And I really think it's one of those situations where we really need to know more about it, but I think that that can be very beneficial for pain management.
Right now, Congress is considering a number of gun violence-related measures. I'm going to ask you about some of those. Where do you stand on each of the following proposals? Raising the age to purchase a rifle to 21.
You know, that's not something that I necessarily agree with. I think if you go through hunter safety and you are certified to use a gun, a rifle, handgun, and if you're 18, I feel you should be able to purchase one.
How about banning the sales of what are called semi-automatic weapons?
People sometimes will group semi-automatic weapons and say we should ban them all. Most rifles are semi-automatic. I'm for the banning of semi-automatic style assault-style weapons that, with the addition of a bump stock or some other type of technology being added to it, can be made fully automatic. I'm all for banning those. We found in the past when they were banned in the late 90s into the 2000s that there was a big drop in gun deaths related to these semi-automatic weapons.
Related to that, of course, is the sale of large ammunition magazines. Would you vote to ban them, were you in Congress?
I would. I don't think there's any reason to have anything beyond 10 cartridges in a clip. When you're duck hunting, you can only have three. So I think that's a common sense rule, and I don't really see the need for having more than 10 in a clip.
President Trump continues to insist on spending billions of dollars to build a border wall with Mexico. There are many other pressing infrastructure needs. You've mentioned some: roads, bridges, high-speed internet access. Please rank in order of importance where you would place on those three. Is it roads first, internet access first, or the border wall?
I would say, for me, it's broadband first, roads and bridges really, really close behind there. It's a tie for me, really. And border wall third, and if I could go even further back, it'd be further. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. My wife grew up in Arizona. We visit southern Arizona to see her family, and I've seen the border wall. I've been there, and it's absolutely ridiculous. People are going to get over it, under it, however they go. I think there's a lot more that can be done these days with electronic surveillance and aerial surveillance. And you know, the Chinese built a wall, and that didn't keep out the barbarians. So I don't see that we really a wall in along the Mexican border is going to help us in any way.
Now, you say it's difficult to differentiate which is first, internet access or roads and bridges. Why do you see those so close together?
Well, because I see our deteriorating infrastructure. So it's these things that were here that we should have been maintaining all along. But for me, broadband is really that interstate highway system of the 1950s in today's world. And we need that access. I mean, we need that. And it's not just for streaming Netflix. This is really, we need that access for people who access medical information. We can monitor patients in their homes. We can keep people in their homes longer. I really just don't see the need to hang back on that and say, well, the market will figure it out. Private industry will do it. If private industry was going to do it, they would have wired this entire state in every household. And I just don't see that happening. And I think that's something the federal government needs to be involved in.
There's legislation pending in Congress both to protect the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, and to fire him. Where would you come down? Do you need legislation to protect him?
I don't like to think that we need legislation to protect him, but I do think that we do. You would think in this day and age that we should be able to let a seasoned professional in the law enforcement who'd been the director of the FBI do his job without interference, the job that he's mandated to do. But it appears as though we may need to have some type of protection. I would certainly vote to protect him and the investigation he's conducting.
We've had reports come out now from intelligence committees and from various officials in the federal government that Russia did try to influence our elections in 2016. What should Congress do in response to those Russian efforts?
I think we need to be funding even additional monitoring of what's going on with incoming traffic from Russia through the internet and online. And if there are violations, we have to be right on top of it with sanctions. We can't have people messing around with free elections in the United States. And we shouldn't be doing anything similar to what they're doing by retaliating by doing something in Russian elections. I don't think we would. But again, I think we need to monitor this closely. It needs to be a priority of the U.S. government, and it also needs to have sanctions attached if we do find it again.
So it's not good enough to just try to protect our voting systems from tampering. We need to try to do something to stop those attempts to influence.
I think so. I think you really have to. I mean, that's really we've seen with the use of bots and other things that it is an incredible game that they have played, and it's only going to get worse if we're not right at the front lines pushing back.
The drug crisis continues to claim about a person a day in Maine. What specific policies would you advocate for in Congress to address the problem?
The first thing I would do is I want to see that we decriminalize opioid abuse so that it is something that is treated as a medical condition, as an addiction, and that, number one, we do that. Number two, that when people come into that system, they simply aren't given Narcan and sent home, that they're actually put into treatment facilities that helps them get through that process and to get clean, in effect. But then also we need to provide housing. A lot of this happens. People get injured, they get on an opioid painkiller, they become addicted, then things spiral out of control and suddenly they're homeless, so they're living in very sketchy situations. We need to have adequate housing for people so they can go into recovery, they have a place to go, and there's a stability there that will keep them clean even after they've gotten that drug out of their system.
Is Congress putting enough money into the treatment of these folks?
I don't think so. I think some states that have those funds or are able to fund it, and maybe it's not as much of a crisis in the state. I think in states like Maine, West Virginia, Kentucky, I think that the federal government needs to be helping in some way to alleviate that problem. And I think Congress also needs to be going after these companies that willingly marketed these in states that they saw as rural and unhealthy or have a lot of unhealthy people, and that they really targeted the least vulnerable in our society.
What about more enforcement of the laws? Because a lot of these drugs are illegal, and we have a problem of them coming into this country from other countries.
Yeah, I think you have to do that, too. You have to kind of limit that illegal trade that's coming in, and it has to be It's a multi-pronged approach, I guess is what we say. We've got to limit what's coming in. We have to help those folks who are addicted. And then we have to make sure that we go after the suppliers saying, this is not right. This is not what you do just to strengthen your balance sheet.
Unless you have really strong majorities in both the House and Senate, you're going to have to reach across the aisle to ensure that any of your priorities pass. How will you do that?
Really, for me, it's just like living in a small town. Number one, I think Congress should be working Monday through Friday. I think they should be in session from early Monday morning till late Friday evening. Right now, they're in session till midday Tuesday to late on Thursday. And I think that additional time in Congress working with colleagues, you have to reach across the aisle. I think we've gotten to the point in politics where we don't know people who are not members of our party as people. We simply know them as opponents. And we curate our news and we curate our relationships so that we're only dealing with people who agree with us. And then when we go to work on something, we have a very difficult time coming to compromise. I live in a small town. There are a lot of people that I disagree with politically, diametrically opposed on political reasons. But we still get along. We serve on committees. I like them, generally like them as people. And I know for many of these people, 3 a.m. in the morning, if I needed something, they would be there to help. And I think we need to do more of that at the federal level.
do you think the parties have become too polarized in Congress where they get into these positions and it becomes a party position and you as a Democrat are told you've got to vote for this because it's the Democratic position?
I absolutely believe that. And I think we see it. We see it in the State House here in Maine. We see it here in local politics that people have become so entrenched in their camps that they're really looking at the organization and its health or perceived health more than they're looking at the people who elected them to serve.
As you know, the president's proposed exploratory drilling for oil and gas off the East Coast. Would you support that or not, and why?
Absolutely not. We slowly have to wean this dependence on foreign oil away from our country. And so for me, absolutely no type of drilling for oil or any type of energy system off of the coast of Maine. Number two, we need to be putting more funding into alternative energy systems like wind, solar, and tidal. I mean, those tides come in every day. I know there's technology out there or down the road that really could power a decent portion of coastal Maine at least. But the wind turbine project that the University of Maine's Composite Center is proposing and working on prototypes, I think it's an absolute perfect situation for Maine, not only with our forest products industry and being able to supply the material for those turbines, but also having the highest wind rates in the country 30 miles off the coast of Maine, where you wouldn't see these turbines, and a 64-turbine field, which would be 8 miles by 8 miles, would power half of the state. I just find that incredible. And so I think we need to have a mixture. We're not going to wean ourselves off of oil and fuel oil in the next 5 years, but I think it has to be a gradual process, and we have to start now.
But when you listen to some of the supporters of drilling, they're saying in the near future, the next 10, 20 years, we're still going to be dependent on oil and natural gas, and we should be doing that from U.S. sources and not importing it.
And that's true. I just don't think that drilling off the coast of Maine is the right thing. We already have these shale oil fields in the Dakotas and in southern Canada and Calgary. I think at this point our source of oil is fairly stable within the U.S. That market has gotten a little volatile. Things boom and bust. But we can't be putting into infrastructure or despoiling that coast of Maine by drilling and taking that possibility of having some type of an oil spill like we had with Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico. That is not something that I ever would want to take the chance on.
Do you support protecting the federal status of the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument that may be challenged at some point in Congress?
I absolutely do. I think it's an important to the economy of that region in around Millinocket and Baxter State Park. I've been there. It's a fabulous piece of property. I'm so happy the state of Maine has it, or we have it in the state of Maine. I actually would really like to see it move up to park status so that it wouldn't have there are not then the possibilities of being carved out for other uses that would be intrusive to the reasons for saving it.
Craig Olson, one of three Democrats vying for a chance to challenge incumbent Congressman Bruce Poliquin in Maine's 2nd District this fall. He spoke with Maine Public's Mal Leary as part of our series of Your Vote 2018 candidate interviews. Next, Diane Russell served 4 terms in the Maine House of Representatives from 2008 to 2016. Term limited, she ran unsuccessfully for a seat in the Maine Senate. Russell works as a public relations consultant. She earned a bachelor's degree at the University of Southern Maine. As Russell told Maine Public's Patty White, she believes she's different from the other Democrats in the race.
The fact of the matter is, no one else is talking about a state public bank, about getting our money out of Wall Street and putting it onto Main Street so we can actually take our treasury and invest it better. No one's talking about an economic security bill of rights, which is essentially a new deal, the right to a job. If the private sector is not providing you a job that pays $15 an hour with benefits, there are roads that could be paved, there are potholes everywhere that could be filled, and there's trash that can be cleaned up. Let's hire Maine people to do Maine work. We want to make sure that we have a public option retirement system to supplement Social Security for people so that, Maine is the oldest state in the country, why wouldn't we be building a supplemental retirement system for the next generation? Everybody's talking about fixing today's problems, but we need to be talking about the problems that are coming up or planning ahead so that we don't have those problems. And of course, you know, I strongly support ranked choice voting. I have been leading that fight since 2007, and without equivocation, I support Medicare for All. And I am delighted to hear that now, after many, many months, most of the candidates in the Democratic primary now support a single-payer health care system in Maine.
Tell me more. The first thing you mentioned was the public bank. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. So the Bank of North Dakota has been doing business since 1912, and essentially North Dakota does business as the Bank of North Dakota, meaning their entire treasury, all of their assets are property of the bank, but the bank is property of the state. So they actually take their money, and instead of investing your treasury, which is the tax revenue that you pay to the state when you pay your income taxes or your sales taxes, nobody thinks about where that goes. Some of that money gets stored in community banks in Maine, and that should stay the same. But a lot of it gets invested on Wall Street, Bank of America, TD Bank, a lot of these major banks that were too big to fail and yet failed our economy. Why would we continue investing our money there when we can actually invest it here in things like infrastructure? Most infrastructure projects, 40% of the project is just on interest alone. That's the cost. Let's start reducing that. Let's bond against ourselves. Let's think about low-interest student loans. Let's think about low-interest small business loans so that we can deploy our capital more effectively. And instead of investing on Wall Street, let's invest in Maine.
What do you think is the biggest challenge facing Maine, and what would you do as governor to respond?
I think there are three major challenges in Maine. I don't think it's just one. I think healthcare is a real challenge for Maine people, and with that, the opioid crisis, which is its own separate issue, and also the economy. And under that, you have, you know, wages are not keeping pace with housing. We have a lot of people buying up real estate and moving to Maine to retire, and they have lovely salaries or lovely pensions that we don't have, and so our housing is really problematic. And with that also is workforce development, making sure that we're closing the skills gap. But also, you know, we need to make sure that students are graduating high school thinking that it's a good thing to go to a two-year or a four-year college. And I think there's been a shift in the last 5 years because of student debt into trying to teach people that they don't necessarily need to get a two-year or a four-year degree. And I think that we do need to get that. It's part of our competitiveness as a state and part of our competitiveness as a country worldwide. So we need to be still teaching people to aspire, but we have to address student loan debt.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you would do to improve Maine's economy, just because voters consistently in polls say that jobs are a top concern?
So first and foremost, this is why the economic security package is so important, because if Maine people are not secure in their economics, they're not going to spend money. So the better that workers do, the better we all do. So that's why it's important to be able to have a $15 minimum wage. It's why it's important to have paid sick days and paid family leave so that people can actually be secure in their job. It's important to have a retirement system that's going to be there, a public option one. Those are the kinds of things that build a strong, sustainable economy. And again, there are no silver bullet solutions right away. We have to be able to be planning for the next generation and beyond and have a much longer term thinking in how we do things. But there's another piece to this. A lot of people are going to talk to you about how they could create jobs. Let's talk about how I have created jobs. I've created an entire industry that was super controversial. In April of 2011, I introduced legislation to legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana in the state. I was the only state lawmaker in the country. And it wasn't easy as a woman to do this either. And yet, I saw a vision of how we could be better utilizing our police resources and investing in our economy. And the thing is that we now have millions and millions of dollars that are being invested right now in this state, very quietly. You don't even see it. And thousands of jobs have been created in anticipation of the new market. That is how you create jobs. You have to open up sectors of the economy responsibly and show people that they're welcome here and that their investment is welcome here. And that's something that we have not done over the last 8 years for sure. But really, Maine has not done that for a long time.
And as you know, Maine voters are going to be using ranked choice voting for this primary election. So assuming that you would put yourself as your first choice, who would you choose as your second and third choice and why?
You know, I think Maine people are smart enough to make their own decisions. I don't like telling people how I'm going to vote because I don't like them thinking that I'm going to influence their vote. What I will say is that we had a real fight to get ranked choice voting. When I introduced it all those years ago, I've been working on it since 2007. People thought I was crazy, that no one would understand this system, that it was why would you possibly want multiple choices? So I don't care who people's second choice candidate is. What I do care about is that you vote yes on one and that you send a message to Augusta that Maine people's voices matter. And if you're an independent and you're not getting to the polls in the primary, I strongly suggest you get there and vote yes on one. And you know what? Register as a Democrat and vote for the one candidate in the primary that has actually been fighting for independent voices against all odds.
So nationally, Maine ranks very low in terms of gun violence, but guns are involved in almost half of all domestic violence homicides. Do you think that Maine's gun laws should be changed, and if so, how?
So I grew up hunting as a kid, and I grew up around guns. I'm pretty handy with one, quite frankly, and I had a DOE permit by 12. So I grew up in a culture that taught me, first and foremost, about safety. Gun safety has always been a core component of gun culture. And so I think that what the NRA is doing right now and leaning in heavily to their gun manufacturers is actually inconsistent with the values of most gun owners in Maine. And most gun owners in Maine agree that they do not believe that criminals and violent people should have access to guns. Do we think that John Williams should have had access to a weapon? No, I don't think any gun owner in the state would believe that. And so I do think that there are reasonable recommendations that can be made, reasonable changes around, nobody needs bump stocks. If you need a 20 capacity magazine, then you're not going hunting, let's be honest. And I don't think that we need, I do think that we need a universal background checks. And I've talked to gun shop owners who agree with that. They're like, absolutely, we should have those.
So Maine currently has a low unemployment rate, but we still rank 44th in the nation for median household income. What would you do to help Maine workers earn more?
Well, first and foremost, this is exactly why we need a jobs guarantee program, and we need to be bumping up the minimum wage. As we talked about, the fact of the matter is people are moving into the state who have money or have out-of-state jobs that they can telecommute from now, and Maine people are seeing their housing dramatically increase as a direct result. It's creating a real crisis and, frankly, a bubble. We also have to address student loan debt because it is stifling people from being able to get into careers that they want to get into, or even if they do get a college education, then they're stuck unable to pay back their student loans. So we have to have a comprehensive approach. But again, this is exactly why the New Deal is so important to Maine. Raising up the living standard of workers, whether it's wages or health care. And this is another reason why we need health care. You know, why is it that we're spending so much of our income on health care and getting so little in return? It is time to re-envision our public health system and get the profits out of health care because, you know, what's the point of being the richest country in all of human history if you can't provide basic health care for your people? And I think that Maine could be a real leader on that.
So Maine is one of the more expensive states for electricity customers. Do you think, as governor, you should try to lower power costs, and how?
So the only way that CMP really makes money is if they build new transmission and distribution towers, the big towers, right? And they get a guaranteed 13.5% profit from the federal government. We are incentivizing them to build out bigger systems that don't necessarily provide a value to the ratepayers. So that's part of the problem. We need to really look at that. The other piece is we need to be looking at distributed renewable energy and allowing Maine people to be able to become self-sufficient. We talk a lot about net metering for solar power, for example, but that just gets you to zero, right? So you're making this significant investment in solar power to get your monthly bill to zero. But imagine if most of these people are putting more energy onto the grid and CMP and Emera are making money off of that. Why shouldn't individual consumers be able to make money off the grid?
So laws have been made over the years about attracting businesses to Maine, and some believe that tax incentives are the way to do that. Do you see these programs as effective economic development tools or corporate welfare?
It depends on the tax incentive. There is a lot of corporate welfare built into our tax code. I do think that direct investments are better because you have to actually budget for it. The problem with tax credits in general is that it's off the books. It's not something that you make a decision about every year. You don't look at that and say, well, how are we going to spend this, right? It's money that doesn't come in. The other thing is, I think we need to look at how we deploy it and who we deploy it to. So What I mean by that is that there's a huge wealth inequality in this country, and very much so in this state. You know, there's definitely the haves and the have-nots, and there are fewer have-nots than there are haves. So what if we were providing, with our corporate marginal tax rate, what if we were providing small businesses, local businesses, who whose wage differential between the CEO and the average worker or the median worker, imagine if you were able to provide a better corporate marginal tax rate to those companies and to the Walmarts of the world and the big box stores who their CEOs are making 400, 500 times the median income of their average worker. Imagine what we could do if we were actually charging them more. And those people are externalizing their costs, right? They're externalizing their healthcare costs because they're not paying for it, and so they're expecting the state to pay for it. They're putting food stamps. Their kids are their employees are getting food stamps, and we do need to be having some clawbacks in our corporate programs too. We create this program, this tax credit, and companies are like, oh, we're going to create 1,600 jobs or whatever it is, and they're going to be good paying jobs. We promise. But there's never any reevaluation on the other end of that.
What about Maine's welfare system? Is it too generous? Is it falling short just right? What, if any, changes would you make to it?
We should be judged based on how we treat the least among us and not how we treat the best among us. And right now, we treat the best among us very well, and we treat the least among us very terribly. So we need to rebalance that. We need to look at how all those federal investments that we have turned down or missed deadlines for, we need to get that held to account as well and get that reorganized. We need to make sure that state workers are not doing one person doing the job of three or four people, which is exactly how children end up in crisis situations. We also need to look at the foster care system. I think we all have seen through devastation that this doesn't always work. And I've heard from time and time again, these kids are having a real hard time, and they're troubled kids because they come from difficult backgrounds. And we need to make sure that we are boosting up our foster care system because we have to make sure that we're investing in our children.
Maine voters overwhelmingly approved Medicaid expansion, but the governor and the legislature have been at odds about how to fund it. Do you support Medicaid expansion, and then how would you fund it?
I support Medicaid expansion. I actually would like to get us to a Medicare for All system, and as elected governor, I will do that. And Medicaid expansion is the first step in that direction. And it's important to understand that we are turning down so much money every day, right? And so it's not about how you'll fund it. It's about how much money we have lost. But this is part of a bigger problem, and this is why I'm running for governor. And that is that the government so did not work for the last 8 years, because it has no leadership. Because of that, you have people going to the ballot box to govern for themselves because they've decided that the legislature is not going to do it, so we're going to do it for you. And then they come back and the legislature overturns it. It's not just Medicaid expansion. It's ranked choice voting. Like I said, we had to do a citizens initiative. Then we had to do a people's veto, getting 80,000 signatures in the middle of the winter, a bad winter by that. And then we had to sue the state, and then we got sued by the Senate, right? I mean, they sued the people to try to stop it. This is how far we have come through the looking glass. It's irrational. At what point is it okay for politicians to declare war on the voters that elect them? I am hoping voters will unelect them and boot them out.
Does the state pay its fair share of local education costs? And if not, how much more should it cost?
The state would have paid its fair share of education costs if it had not repealed the 3% tax on incomes over $200,000, because, you know, being Robin Hood apparently is no longer cool in this state. Again, Maine people went to the ballot box. They said, we want the rich to pay their fair share, and we would like that to go to education. They paid for it. They voted for it, and then the legislature went and completely repealed it. So we would have had the amount that we needed. The other thing that we need to look at is revenue sharing. Again, when the governor passed his tax breaks for the rich, $400 million, he did not pay for it. So the next term, in the next budget cycle, he started pulling money out of revenue sharing. And what happens is that you're putting the burden on property taxpayers. And so now you're seeing the elderly again pitted against school children. because the elderly can't afford their increased in property taxes, and they're like, well, I don't have any kids in the school system anymore. Why should I be paying for that? It's a false choice, and we need to start thinking about real choices.
Maine is experiencing a teacher shortage also, so how would you incentivize more Mainers to consider a career in teaching?
We need to pay them fairly. You know, we were asked if $40,000 was a good starting salary for a teacher, and I was like, that's it? Like, why aren't we paying teachers $50,000 a year as a starter and then helping them get further and further educated so that they get to be better at what they do? And why are we not listening to teachers on how best to teach and to deploy resources to the classrooms? And why are we not listening to teachers about the very real challenges that poverty is creating in the school systems? And also, the teachers that are good are gravitating to the school systems that are willing to pay and are willing to support those good teachers, which means that the more poverty-driven, stricken school districts are getting the lower-educated teachers, they're getting the more burdened teachers, and they're paying them less. So you're working twice as hard, you're dealing with kids that really need serious social support, and you're not even getting paid for the privilege. So there's a lot that we need to do to restore the teachers, but we need to first start by making it a career that is valued. And I think it's important to understand that teachers are predominantly women. There are a lot of men in the teaching industry, but it is lower salaries because we do not value the contributions of women.
Do you think that Maine's referendum process is working as intended? And why or why not? And if no, how would you change it?
I absolutely believe the process is working as intended, right? So there are people that, you know, with the casino referendum, it was a classic example. They spent all that money. They debauched it. They did everything that you could do it to make it to violate the process. And Maine people voted, after all that money and all those signs, 85% said no. Not because it was a casino, but because it was that project. Nobody wanted that person to have it. It is your constitutional right in Maine to petition your government. And there's a lot of people in Augusta that want you to think that that right should go away. They want to convince you through seductive, silver-tongued crap that you should maybe give that right up because maybe they are the ones that know better. But I think it's clear that they don't know better. And the fact of the matter is, it is incredibly hard. Yes, I helped lead the fight to get not one, but two on the ballot in 2016, ranked choice voting and legalization. It is one of the hardest, most difficult processes you could possibly go through to get on the ballot. People have no idea how hard it is, and lawmakers have no idea. And lawmakers, I can't tell you, they say to me, I'm like, I've served 8 years. Who do you think you're talking to? They're like, well, they just didn't read the bill. You don't read the bill. Let's be clear. There are 2,500 bills in the legislature. You might read 50. So you're not smarter than voters. You don't do more work than the voters. And you should stop trying to take away the rights of voters. It makes me so angry. There's this whole view in Augusta that voters are somehow stupid. And we're not. We might get it wrong on occasion. That does not make us stupid.
So there's a working theory that the country is so polarized that it's best for elected officials to keep their supporters happy and loyal rather than come together for compromise or build coalitions that could alienate them. Do you believe that that's true? And if so, what should be done about it?
The country is polarized, and that's because the leaders have used race and gender and faith lines in order to divide us, right? But I think what you're going to see is there's a whole generation of people who are working in politics who are tired of fighting our parents' battles. And I think you're going to see some interesting people who you would never assume got in the room. Get in the room and remove the establishment on both sides of the aisle. If you are part of the old school, old guard, I want to do it the way we've always done it, and you are a Republican, get out. If you are part of the old school, old guard, we're going to do it the way we've always done it, Democrat, get out. You're the problem. And I think you're going to see that on both sides of the aisle. And so what's happening is that there are Republicans and like conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats that are working on public policy together. Most people would be shocked to know that I am good friends with Eric Brakey. I disagree with him on gun policy and a whole host of other policies. He's running for U.S. Senate. I will not be voting for Eric. However, we have worked together on some remarkable legislation, including criminal justice reform. Because progressives and libertarian Republicans tend to work really well together. And you'd be surprised at how many deeply conservative people I am very, very close friends with as a Bernie Sanders progressive. So it's all about building trust. And again, if you are part of the establishment on the Republican side or the Democratic side, watch out, because we are coming and we are going to replace you.
Candidates for governor often talk about transparency in government. Can you tell me, how important is it that people know what is happening with their government?
Absolutely. People should have confidence in their government. I will say there are times when people need to be able to say things that they might not need to be to say out loud in public because they can their words can be twisted. And so we need to have space for real discussion to happen. But for the most part, I think transparency is absolutely important. People should know what's going on and they should be able to make educated decisions accordingly. Ironically, it's usually the people that scream transparency the most that are the least transparent.
Beyond signing bills into law, what can a governor do to improve the lives of Mainers?
First and foremost, set a new tone. And I think Maine people, I grew up in here, I grew up in Western Maine in Bryan Pond, and just the tone that has been set and the way that we have been portrayed in the media is so bad. I mean, I led the fight nationally to take on the superdelegate system, which that fight was about the power of the party. And as part of it, the top echelon of the Democratic Party came down. It was a whole host of events, but that was certainly the biggest contender part of it. And, you know, I was even in the original WikiLeaks, which is talk about having a front row seat to history. So as I led that fight and I was asked to speak at the Democratic National Convention for Bernie, all I kept thinking is, I have to represent Maine people, and so I have to be as good and as positive and send a message to the country that there are good people here. I should have been able to walk out on that stage and just be who I was and not think about it. But because of the tone that this governor has set, because of the reputation that he has set, I had to really take it that much more to the level because I didn't want to let people down. We need a new tone, and we need Maine people to feel proud of who we are again, because we are a proud people. And we are, you know, we're the most disjointed from any other part of the country. So we are truly independent. And so I think setting a new tone is very, very important. The other piece to it is building an economy, of course. But those are things that governors over a series of policies can do. The one skill set that I bring to the table that is very different than anybody else. So yes, I know how to move an agenda through the legislature, and I'm really good at it. However, most governors will only look at how do you move a bill through the legislature to turn it into law. I have a different skill set, and that is taking my case to the people. And I've done it twice, now three times. And I think we're going to win in June on RCV. So my track record's pretty good there. I know how to get issues on the ballot. And so if the legislature, I don't think that we should be governing by citizens' initiative. And I think with a new administration, we won't have to. However, if the legislature won't pass Medicare for All, and I know Maine people are ready for it, I will happily lead a signature drive. And I think it's about governing with the people and not just for them. So being able to use the citizens' initiative process as an added tool in the toolbox gives a lot of leverage, and it also means that we get to write the most impressive, useful healthcare system, the most innovative, bold version of it, our best selves, and we get to pass it. And yes, while we may need to make tweaks once it's passed in order to implement it, as governor, I get to veto any effort to try to undermine it. That's a lot of power, and that's what I'm running for governor for. I want to put power back into the hands of people, and I trust where people are. And if people disagree with me, it just means that A, they're not ready, B, maybe I'm wrong, or C, I haven't made the best case yet. And sometimes those cases take a long time. RCV, I've been working on since 2007. Marijuana legalization since 2011. And all these governor's candidates across the country are like getting all this national press like, oh my God, they came out for weed. And Chuck Schumer, you know, Cory Booker, all these people, even John Boehner. Well, and there's this young woman from Maine that also was way ahead of the curve. Where's your press? Right? Where are the accolades for being out there when there's no one standing there? Like, great, come on in, the water's warm. When I jumped in, there were polar bears swimming around. It was so cold.
So Maine's received failing grades for the conditions of its infrastructure, and it currently has a backlog of deferred maintenance of roads and bridges. Yet bipartisan proposals to deal with the problem have gone nowhere, and the solution has been to ask voters to borrow for transportation bonds. Mm-hmm. Is this sustainable? And if not, what is your solution?
Well, so my dad gets up at 2:30 in the morning to get the equipment to the side of the road so that people can pave those roads. So I have been hearing about this for a long time, but it doesn't take having a dad in the paving industry to know that your alignment is going to go every time you hit a pothole, or to know that there are potholes everywhere and bad roads. Just drive Route 1 down through Machias. The difference between Route 1 and the airline is stunning. So one thing that people don't know about is that in addition to the tax breaks for the rich, we have two budgets. One is the biennial budget that we all know about, but there's also a transportation budget. And that year, and it was the only time I ever voted against the transportation budget, and I had to call my dad and be like, Dad, I'm voting against this, just so you know, I'm really sorry. But the reason I did was because they repealed the gas tax. And so the gas tax was indexed to inflation. And so it would automatically increase incrementally to support our roads. And that was repealed 8 years ago. And it has had devastating consequences. So when we are paving our roads, we're not actually paving them. We're putting on what's known as a skinny mix. It's like putting a Band-Aid on a tumor. And meanwhile, most of our roads need to be dug up and redone. And there's modern pavement that can be used that, you know, that lasts so much longer. But we're not able to make those investments because we have politicians in Augusta that have signed a tax pledge from Grover Norquist and the American Tax Foundation to never raise taxes, or at least not to raise them without cuts elsewhere. So if you can't raise the money to do the roads, then you're not going to do the roads. And I think Republicans have done a really good job of being like, tax and spend liberal, or isn't a bad person. Well, you know what? Yeah, tax people so that they can get value for their stuff. It's not that people don't want to pay money, they just want value for it. Why would you feel like you were getting your value in your taxes if you then had to pay $80 on an alignment? I'd rather pay two extra dollars in a tax than $80 in an alignment every 4 months because I hit a pothole. So as far as I'm concerned, the politicians that don't want to fund our roads, you know, just go find a pothole somewhere and dive into it, because maybe they'll just disappear.
What are Maine's three greatest assets, and how would you best leverage those qualities to improve Mainer's economy?
Our people are number one. We have one of the best workforces in the country. We just have to make sure that we channel them. Two is our quality of place. It's not just essential to our way of life here. It's also what inspires people to come. We do not want to look like New Jersey. We want to preserve those parts of the industry, parts of the region. And I think our forestry, fishing, and farming economy is really special. When you can do farm to table and you've got working forests, all of those things really add to the quality of life. We just have to raise up our incomes so that people who were born and raised here can still afford to stay here when they retire.
Diane Russell, one of seven Democrats in this year's Maine gubernatorial primary. She spoke with Maine Public's Patty White. If you missed either of our candidate interviews in this past hour, you can hear all 14 conversations at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You can also learn much more about each of the candidates and see their positions broken down on an easy-to-use issues grid near the top of our Your Vote page. I'm Keith Shortall. Thanks for listening.